middle, show the little documentary, then go back to the blockbuster?
Then go back to the film. And then people will leave, not talking about the film, but just talking about that short clip. So, and these women had put in hand washing stations, all of the different things. So people then begin to start washing their hands and taking all the necessary precautions.
And what number are you at now of Ebola victims in Liberia?
Well, we're at zero, and hopefully in 5 or 6 days, we're supposed to be counting down to Liberia being Ebola-free by the World Health Organization. And I think the success is not government, is not flying in the U.S. military, is community, engage communities.
Well, we're going to leave it at that. 5 seconds for each of you to wrap up this with you women of wisdom in this time of war. Mairead McGuire.
Well, you know, America is a great country. And Eleanor Roosevelt was one of the contributors to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And you have a wonderful constitution. But revive your constitution, rededicate yourselves to international law,
Jody,
and be a peacemaker, not a war.
Jody Williams, you have 2 seconds.
Nothing about us without us. Women need to be involved in all aspects of peace and security.
Lame Bowie.
Since we're in the Hague, do one good thing every day that everyone else is scared to do.
We will leave it at that. Lame Bowie and Mairead McGuire and Jody Williams, thanks so much. Special thanks to Julie Crosby, Mike Burke, John Hamilton. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website, democracynow.org. Thanks so much.
The Creative Music Guild, Merrillhurst University, and KBOO Community Radio are proud sponsors of a weekend residency by Mark Rabeau, May 8th and 9th at Merrillhurst University. Renowned guitarist and composer Mark Rabeau will perform a solo concert on Friday, May 8th at 8 p.m. and will lead a workshop on group-free improvisation on Saturday, May 9th from 2 to 5. The workshop is open to musicians of any experience level, and all instruments are welcome. Both events are taking place at the St. Anne's Church on the Merrillhurst campus, 17600 Pacific Highway, which is Highway 43. More information about the May 8th and 9th events featuring Mark Rabeau can be found on kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Hi, this is Sun Lee, KBOO's Membership Director. I want to thank you for being a member and a listener to KBOO. I also wanted to share this listener's comment on why they support KBOO.
Django and Pandora and Spotify are okay, but just get boring, and I find myself wanting a real live DJ, choosing songs that aren't things I've heard 1,000,000,000 times. Thanks for the curated, unpredictable shows. Maria from Portland, Oregon.
We hope that you feel the same. Please support your community and your local radio station by going to kboo.fm/give.
The time is 5:02 p.m. You're listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, it's the KBOO Evening News.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, protests continue in Baltimore over the police shooting of Freddie Gray, an unarmed black man.
A massive earthquake in Nepal has killed thousands of people over the weekend.
And supporters gathered at the Portland Zoo this weekend to save the life of Packy the elephant.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Monday, April 27th, 2015. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Eric Tegedoff. A rally for Packy the Elephant was held last Saturday at the Oregon Zoo to protest poor living conditions faced by the zoo's elephants. The 53-year-old Packy is suffering from numerous physical ailments, and animal rights activists are calling for Packy to be able to retire to the Northern California free-range animal sanctuary. Pause. KBOO's Don Zur interviewed Sandy Miller, a board with the organization to free the Oregon Zoo elephants.
Packy was born in 1962 as the first elephant born in the Western Hemisphere in many years, so there was a big to-do about it. He was born at that zoo, and he has spent Now 53 years on concrete at the Oregon Zoo.
Yeah, he is actually the top moneymaker for the Oregon Zoo, is he not?
Absolutely. After he was born that year, the zoo got 1 million visitors, and he has been, he's kind of an icon, I think, for the zoo. But in fact, Packy has been out of the public view now for some time. And up to this year, his birthday on April 14th was a big event for the zoo, a big festivity open to the public. This is the first year he turned 53 on April 14th this year, and no one at the zoo said anything about it. Instead, they had an event called Elephantastic a couple of weeks later. So Packy is not on public view because he's sick. He has active tuberculosis, and he's old. He's old for an elephant, 53.
And Packy's son, Rama, just died on March 31st of this year. Can you tell us about Rama?
Yeah, Rama was Packy's son, and Rama was just short, I believe, of 33. So he was 32 years old. I might mention that the lifespan of an elephant in the wild, of an Asian elephant like all of ours are, is about 60 years on average. So Rama lived only about half the lifespan that he might have in the wild, and he was in pain from an old injury, apparently, and had a miserable life.
Can you tell us about the living conditions for elephants at the Oregon Zoo as compared to their normal living conditions in the wild?
Oh, absolutely. They're living now on about an acre. This is for now 7 elephants. And Elephant Lands, the new expansion on site at the zoo, will increase that acreage to about 4 acres. But in reality, in the wild, these animals would be walking 20, 30 miles a day. And this is essential to keeping them healthy because foot rot, really painful and horrible disease, which they get in captivity only, never in the wild. Foot rot is caused by these sedentary conditions where they don't have a chance to walk. So the zoo will be telling people, and has been, that Elephant Lands is a great, wonderful expansion that is going to solve all the problems. But in fact, it's just a drop in the bucket. It's not anywhere near what they need. Plus, the zoo is planning to double the size of the herd through breeding in the future, which means that each elephant would have even less space.
And also, Packy exhibits head bobbing. Can you explain head bobbing and how that, and elephants?
Yeah, absolutely. Head bobbing and trunk waving and swaying back and forth, those are all examples of what we call stereotypical behavior. You see in many zoo animals, but in particular in elephants, it's a sign of extreme stress. We have video of Packy, of Rama, of Chandra, one of the other a female elephant there in the at the zoo. We have video of all of them showing extreme stereotypical behavior.
And have you had any response from the zoo management?
The zoo and Metro, which controls the zoo, have been absolutely deaf to our pleas. And we've had, you know, some limited success trying to get the word out to the public. But we're really hoping to get a lot of people to come to the Metro meeting on May 14th, that's a Thursday at 2 p.m., to testify on behalf of Packy and the other elephants.
So your organization would like to see Packy be able to retire to the Paws Animal Sanctuary in Northern California. Can you tell the listeners about the Paws Sanctuary?
I can tell you about Paws, but I will say we don't know if Paws could or would take Packy. We do know he needs to go to sanctuary, and the only people who can ask Paws or any sanctuary to take Packy are Metro. We have no standing, if you will. So Paws, in contrast to our zoo, has over 200 acres for its elephants, and that is about 10 to 12 elephants at this time. And they have huge pools and hills to roam. It's just a wonderful setting. And elephants who have been in circuses for many years, like Prince, one of our elephants born at the zoo, suffered in circuses for many years, but finally finally, a few years ago, was retired to PAWS, and he is just a happy camper. And so we'd really love to see Packy go there. But in any case, it has to start with Metro saying, you know, Packy has done his time. He has been a huge moneymaker for the zoo. Now he's old and he's sick, and he needs to go to sanctuary.
The animal rights organization, In Defense of Animals, has named the Oregon Zoo 5 different years as one of the worst zoos in America for the elephants. How do you think the Oregon Zoo compares to other zoos around the country for how they treat elephants?
Well, I think that they're trying to improve the situation, and many zoos have even worse conditions. But the fact that we have 7 elephants in such a cramped space is an indication that this zoo, and in fact no zoo, is suitable for an elephant.
Hundreds of climate activists have gathered in Seattle on Sunday to protest Shell Oil Company. The oil company plans to house their Arctic drilling rig in a Seattle port. Activists from Greenpeace, the Washington chapter of the Sierra Club, Gabriella Seattle, and Rising Tide Seattle gathered under the slogan, Shell No. At a rally in Myrtle Edwards Park, Annie Leonard of Greenpeace said, "We will not be part of facilitating this pathological addiction to fossil fuels when we know that there is a better way." The rally comes during a growing swell of voices speaking out against climate change and evidence of human damage to our planet. According to a study published in Nature Climate Change, extreme weather events have been on the rise ever since the Industrial Revolution began. The study shows that heat extremes are 4 to 5 times more likely to happen now because of man-made climate change. The battle over Shell in Seattle is, quote, emblematic of a much bigger battle our country is in the midst of, and it is a battle to determine which trajectory we are going to take, unquote. This is according to Annie Leonard. Shell Oil Company gained approval to drill in the Arctic this year from President Obama.
A 16-year-old student was tackled by his teacher after firing 2 shots in the commons area at a high school in Lacey, Washington this morning. No one was hurt in the incident. North Thurston High School, where the shooting took place, is located about 60 miles southwest of Seattle. The teacher who stopped the shooting teaches government and civics. The student is now in custody.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an interview with 2 candidates running for Portland Public School Board Zone 1, followed by the fight for the $15 minimum wage on Labor Radio at 6 o'clock. At 6:30, Prison Pipeline profiles Beating the Odds, a jewelry-making group in McLaren Youth Facility in Woodburn, Oregon. At 7, it'll be Hard Knock Radio news and views from a hip-hop perspective. For the weather tomorrow, there's a 50% chance of rain in the afternoon, and the high will be only 58 degrees and the low 43. Today in history, in 1961, Sierra Leone gained independence after more than 150 years of colonial rule by the British. And in 1994, South Africans voted in their first ever multiracial parliamentary elections. Nelson Mandela was elected in a landslide to be the next president of South Africa. And the quote of the day is from Mandela himself. "Like slavery and apartheid, poverty is not natural. It is man-made, and it can be overcome and eradicated by the actions of human beings."
Tens of thousands of people took to the streets of Baltimore this past weekend to protest the police killing of Freddie Gray, and protests continued today after the burial service. Police killed Freddie Gray, an unarmed black man, by somehow severing his neck from his spinal cord while he was in police custody. Angry protesters poured into the streets of Baltimore Saturday to demand justice. When they approached the baseball stadium where the Baltimore Orioles were playing, several baseball fans attacked the protesters, and hundreds of riot police then charged the protest, attacking with batons and pepper spray. Gang members from the historic rivals Crips and Bloods came together and linked arms in solidarity for the first time in Baltimore's history. They stood in unity, chanting against the racist police in the majority black city of Baltimore. Militarized police took over the streets of Baltimore on Sunday and have continued to patrol the city on Monday. Here's a segment of the Periscope TV live stream from Colin Campbell in Baltimore today.
Where Mondawmin Mall is here in the northwest side of the city, and police and protesters, high school students really, bricks and other projectiles being thrown at them. Tough to estimate how many folks are out here, just because they're sort of dispersed kind of down the street. I don't know what that was. Something glass. Their bottles are being thrown down.
I'm out here for them. I'm out here for this group. This is who I represent. Every day I represent this group.
So you say you're a teacher. Do you recognize any of your students out here?
No. I teach in Westwood. But I taught at four different high schools in the city.
That was audio from a live stream from Baltimore today, which shows militarized police in riot gear marching in lines down the streets of Baltimore, accompanied by an armed personnel carrier. As live streamer Colin Campbell mentioned, many of the protesters were high school students. The Baltimore Police Department today issued a statement calling on parents to bring their children home and keep them out of the streets. Aaron Watson with the National Trial Lawyers Association spoke today on RT Television about the problem of police violence in the U.S.
111 people dead from police encounters. I mean, it's a staggering number. And from my handling these cases, I mean, you see cases in Colorado, Ohio, just last month, even in Florida, of police officers killing unarmed men. I mean, it's a problem. And what I, from my practice, what I've seen is that it's a problem in training. It's a problem in the mentality and thinking that police officers are above the law, that because we have a badge and a gun, that the average everyday citizen doesn't have the rights that the Constitution guarantees. It's a problem.
Yeah, now let me ask you, Aaron, you raised the issue about training, which I think is so important. We've talked about this so many times. And the UK, just to give an example, the UK, 600 hours of training is what a police officer undergoes. In the United States, it's 40 hours. The training in areas in the UK, training specifically in areas from a common sense standpoint, should include things like pursuit in vehicles, riot control, arrest procedures, how to handle a mentally disabled individual, and absolutely firearms training. Now, exactly. As an attorney who day-to-day gets these cases in your office, you evaluate the cases, and you hear what goes wrong. What's wrong with that list of what we should expect from our police departments?
Listen, Pat, you made a very important point. And I think in order to put a microscope on our police departments, it's important to go and look at how other police departments around the world are doing things. And listen, in the UK, you can't even drive a car that can travel the speeds of a highway vehicle, 60, 50 miles an hour, without hundreds of hours of training. You can't carry a gun without having hundreds of hours of training. In our society, in the United States, we train the officers for a few weeks, and the first thing they get is a gun. Let me ask you this. What profession, whether it's a doctor, a lawyer, where you have the lives of a person in your hand, do you get to carry deadly force, make decisions regarding a person's life without sufficient training? To become a lawyer, I had to go to school for 7 years, pass a bar exam. We give our officers 19 weeks of training. They get a gun, they get a badge, they get a car, and say, go out and police our citizens. I think the UK is an important, very important area to look at, because you don't get a gun, you get a baton, you get handcuffs, you get a pepper spray and a radio to call for backup. And those, and it seems in America here, our police officers, rather than go and place hands on a suspect who they think, hey, you know, he's being uncooperative, what they do now is they have a quick fix. The gun is the quick fix. I don't want to talk to you. I don't want to de-escalate the situation. I don't want to get my hands dirty. I don't want to break a sweat. I'm going to pull my gun, and that's going to end the situation altogether. And one other thing with regard to the situation in Baltimore, what you'll see, Pat, is that the first thing I notice is that somebody recorded it. In all these cases across a lot of these cases across the country, you see now people using their cell phones to record the very same people who are supposed to be protecting us. You saw it in the Baltimore case. In fact, just the other day, you saw an officer actually snatch the phone. I mean, when I saw it, Pap, I was outraged. You have a woman there recording an arrest. The officer walks over, snatches the phone, throws it on the ground, and stomps on it.
That was Attorney Aaron Watson speaking on RT today about the epidemic of police violence in the U.S. right now. In Baltimore today, local residents have reported seeing National Guard soldiers along with police, but the federal government has not announced any deployment of National Guard in Baltimore. However, numerous surrounding counties have announced that they are sending additional officers, numbering at least 1,000, to try to put down the protests with a massive show of force.
An Arkansas man filed a lawsuit last week because he was refused medical care in prison for 4 days despite having a prolapsed colon. The suit alleges law enforcement knowingly ignored the man's claims, even though nearly a foot of the man's intestine was protruding from his rectum. The man, identified as Stephen Cook, was left in a dirty cell, exposed to his own blood and feces and in extreme pain. No fewer than 4 detention officials, including a physician, saw the condition Cook was in and agreed that he should be taken to the hospital. However, Assistant Prosecutor Attorney Andy Gill sidelined these plans, saying that Cook could push his rectum inside and out, quote, at will. Cook's attorneys say his 5th and 14th Amendment rights were violated, and he is seeking compensation for cruel and unusual punishment, for permanent injury, and for emotional pain and suffering.
Corinthian Colleges, a for-profit institution, have announced they will be shutting down 28 campuses across the U.S. Heald College campuses in California, Hawaii, and Oregon are among the closures, as well as Everest campuses in California, Arizona, and New York. The unexpected closures will affect around 16,000 students. Only 2 weeks ago, the U.S. Department of Education fined the institution $30 million because of its falsified job placement data and other fraud allegations. Corinthian colleges rely heavily on funding from federal student loans and grants, which in turn generate large amounts of debt for students. From 2007 to 2011, while much of the U.S. economy was suffering, Corinthian College's revenue doubled to $1.75 billion. Last year, they generated $1.2 billion in government loans. The institution has been under continued pressure from the federal government to help students in debt, but Corinthians has largely shirked any responsibility to its students. Last fall, Occupy Wall Street affiliate Strike Debt helped purchase $4 million in student debt owned by former students of Everest College.
A new study by the Consumer Reports organization revealed that more than half of all shrimp sold in U.S. grocery stores tested positive for bacteria and for illegal antibiotics. Researchers tested both raw and cooked shrimp from a variety of stores, including Costco, Albertsons, Walmart, and Kroger, which, by the way, owns Fred Meyer's. 60% of the raw shrimp tested positive for bacteria, including E. coli, Salmonella, and Listeria. The antibiotic-resistant superbug known as MRSA was detected in 2% of all shrimp tested. Shrimp caught in the wild had about half the contamination level that farmed shrimp had, raising questions about how shrimp is raised, processed, and regulated around the world. Most of the farmed shrimp sold here in America comes from Asian shrimp farms in countries all the way from India to Vietnam and Thailand.
The U.S. government has decided to lower the recommended amount of fluoride in drinking water for the first time since fluoride was introduced into municipal water systems over 50 years ago. The decision to lower the amount of fluoride came after multiple studies showing that many people are actually getting too much fluoride. Today, about 75% of Americans drink fluoridated water. In Portland, voters decided in 2013 to reject a measure to add fluoride to the city's drinking water, which comes from the Bull Run watershed and receives very little treatment before reaching the tap. When announcing today's decision to lower the recommended level of fluoride nationwide, the federal government did not mention a 2013 study in the Journal of Environmental Sciences. That study found that the arsenic contained in fluoridating chemicals cost the United States up to $6 billion a year in added health costs. At the time the study was released, Portland was considering adding fluoride to city drinking water, and KBOO's Jay Meyer spoke with Dr. William Hersey, the lead author of the study.
My name is John William Hersey, and I'm currently chemist in residence at American University. I came here after retiring from the Environmental Protection Agency, where I was senior scientist in the risk assessment division of the toxics office.
When we talk about putting fluoride in our water, what are we talking about?
My understanding is the chemical that is intended for use up there in Portland is hydrofluorosilicic acid. And in fact, I just published a paper with several of my students and my former colleague, Bob Carton from EPA, showing that the amount of arsenic that is in that compound is enough to be causing the United States as a society as a whole to be spending probably in between $1 and $6 billion a year treating the lung and bladder cancer cases that come along with that arsenic level in the HFSA. That's completely aside from the toxicity that's associated with the fluoride. That's just the little extra something that comes along at no extra charge from the phosphate people.
Didn't the CDC say this was one of the 10 best health miracles of the 20th century or something?
Yeah, well, that's their claim, but unfortunately, they don't have any statistically significant data to back that up. The best piece of research on whether or not fluoride, in fact, taken systemically, that is, when you drink the stuff, the best study was ever done was done by the National Institute of Dental Research, actually, the part of the National Institutes of Health. They studied 39,000 U.S. teenagers and were unable to show a statistically significant difference in the number of decayed, missing, and filled teeth in the kids who lived all their life in a fluoridated community versus non-fluoridated. It's neither safe nor effective. It hasn't been shown to be effective, and there are plenty of problems with it, not the least of which is the fact that you're getting this arsenic load with the stuff that's being put in your drinking water. And it also affects, fluoride crosses the blood-brain barrier. There's at least 100 times and maybe as much as 400 times more fluoride in fluoridated drinking water than there is in human breast milk. Little babies who are drinking formula made from fluoridated water are being exposed to way excess amount of fluoride than Mother Nature ever intended. That, in fact, was one of the reasons why Arvid Carlson, who is the Nobel Prize winner in medicine in 2000, as a Swedish scientist, was instrumental in getting Sweden to stop fluoridating, was this fact that it's likely impact on the developing brain. And now a recent study from Harvard showing that the higher the fluoride levels in drinking water supplies, the lower the IQ of the children in those areas.
That was Dr. William Hersey, the lead author of a 2013 study that found dangerous levels of arsenic in the fluoridation chemical used in drinking water in the U.S. The federal government today decided to lower the amount of fluoride in drinking water across the country, but did not recommend eliminating water fluoridation altogether.
And news from the Grand Canyon. The United States Forest Service has taken the first steps towards approval of a controversial proposal for a large-scale commercial and resort development on the edge of Grand Canyon National Park. The resort development, by an Italian corporation, calls for more than 2,000 new housing units and 3 million square feet of retail space, along with hotels, a spa, and convention center. The new resort would be located in the small town of Tusayan, located near the southern edge of the canyon. The proposal pits the U.S. Forest Service against the U.S. National Park Service. The superintendent of the National Park Service at the Grand Canyon called the development proposal the worst threat to the Grand Canyon since its inception more than 80 years ago. The U.S. Forest Service plans to begin a National Environmental Protection Act review next month. Public comments will be allowed through June 3rd, and several meetings will be open to the public and held in the month of May.
And now let's hear the latest in worker-related news from our friends at laborradio.org.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The United Steelworkers say Goodyear's decision to build a new plant in Mexico is troubling and disappointing, but not surprising.
USW President Leo Girard says the union and the rank-and-file workers have been willing partners at Goodyear and have worked hard to turn the company around. Girard says the union workers' efforts have significantly contributed to the return of prosperity at Goodyear's North American operations. The USW started discussions with Goodyear about maximizing investment in U.S. plants when it became clear that they were building the new Mexican plant. U.S. demand is outpacing supply for Goodyear tires, but rather than put the new plant where the demand is, Goodyear went to Mexico to supply the U.S. market. Nearly half of all new U.S. jobs don't pay enough to live on, and most of America's job growth is in low-wage occupations. In a 2015 report, the Alliance for a Just Society says America is becoming a low-wage nation, and without action, the low-wage crisis will only get worse. The study defined a living wage as $15 an hour in 2013 dollars. Key findings in the report include that nearly two of five existing jobs pay less than $15 an hour in the U.S., 48% of projected national job openings do not pay $15 or higher, and there aren't enough living wage jobs to go around. So there are seven times more U.S. job seekers than new jobs paying $15 or more. Jerry Mead Lucero's Labor Express Radio is one of several shows being canceled by Loyola University at WLUW-FM in Chicago. The university says it's returning to our roots as a student radio station. WLUW was reincorporated into Loyola's communications department in 2008 after years as an independent community station. In a letter to Mead Lucero and several other producers of long-running shows, Don Hyder, dean of Loyola's School of Communications, said that the weekly Labor Express Radio could move to another station or a podcast and might be able to find a strong audience rather than airing on a student radio station with a signal that only reaches part of Chicago. Loyola management has already refused to postpone the cancellations. This newscast made possible in part through underwriting support from the National Association of Letter Carriers.
Workers Independent News is proud to be heard on The Union Edge, Labor's Talk Radio. Live nationwide weekdays noon to 3 p.m. at theunionedge.com.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Brought to you by the IBEW, 750,000 men and women powering the way for an American comeback. Information on how to become an International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers Power Professional is online at ibew.org.
You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Look at here, it's 5:31 and time for daily commentary from Jim Hightower.
The powers that be are very unhappy with you and me. They're also unhappy with senators like Elizabeth Warren, activist groups like Public Citizen, unions like the communications workers, and, well, with the majority of us Americans who oppose the establishment's latest free trade scam. Despite its benign name, the Trans-Pacific Partnership is a cluster bomb of legalized gotchas. TPP empowers global corporations from Brunei, Japan, Vietnam, and eight other nations to circumvent and even overturn our local, state, and national laws. Those moneyed elites are upset that rabble like us oppose their latest effort to enthrone corporate power over citizen power. And they're particularly peeved that we've found TPP's trigger mechanism, something called investor-state dispute settlements. That's a mouthful of wonky gobbledygook, isn't it? Indeed, ISDS is an intentionally arcane phrase meant to hide its democracy-destroying impact from us. It would create a system of private international tribunals through which corporations, i.e. investors, could sue our sovereign governments to overturn laws that might trim the level of corporate profits that, get this, they expected to make. These tribunals are not part of our public courts of justice, but are totally privatized, inherently biased corporate courts set up by the UN and the World Bank. A tribunal's judges are corporate lawyers, and they unilaterally decide whether the protections we've enacted for workers, consumers, our environment, etc., might pinch the profits of some foreign corporation. This is Jim Hightower saying Jefferson, Madison, Adams, and the other revolutionaries of 1776 would upchuck at this desecration of our nation's democratic ideals, and so should we. To join today's rebellion, go to stoptpp.org.
Hightower's commentaries are brought to you by the Hightower Lowdown, the monthly newsletter with Hightower's take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to. For information, visit hightowerlowdown.org.
A massive earthquake in Nepal Saturday resulted in the deaths of nearly 4,000 people, with thousands more missing and yet to be accounted for. The 7.8 magnitude quake was the strongest to hit the region in 80 years. On Sunday, an aftershock that measured 6.9 sent hundreds of people outdoors, where many remained camped on open roads and fields, afraid to be inside buildings. The Portland-based Mercy Corps organization was among the first to deploy emergency responders, with close to 100 people on the ground in Nepal already. Dozens of countries, including the U.S. government, have promised support for the devastated nation of Nepal.
As the Saudi bombing campaign against Houthi targets in Yemen continues this week, the mainstream media reporting on the crisis continues to frame it as a proxy war between Iran and the U.S. But the weapons used by the Houthi fighters are not coming from Iran. They are U.S. weapons, as are the weapons used by the Yemeni government to put down the rebellion. KBOO's Jenka Soderberg spoke with investigative journalist Gareth Porter about the misreporting by the United States media on what is really going on in Yemen.
U.S. support. Can you just give us a brief overview of what's been happening this week?
Yes. The Saudi campaign to bomb targets in Yemen began in late March, so it's been now going for about a month. And the targets have been really clustered around major cities. This is a very unusual bombing campaign in this regard. I can't think of anything quite like it in recent history because all of the major cities in Yemen have been the targets or have had targets in them that have been hit by the Saudi and their allied bombers. And we know that there have been several hundred civilian casualties. I don't know what the latest figure is, but several days ago it was certainly well over 500, and I think actually more than 700 civilian casualties already. So this is a campaign that clearly is having a great deal of impact on civilian life in Yemen, and there's every reason to believe that it's going to be alienating large segments of the Yemeni population who might otherwise be not so supportive of the Houthi domination or control of the capital.
And what about this U.S. media reporting that includes in virtually every report about this that that Iran has provided financial support, weapons, and training to the Houthis? What's going on there?
Well, first of all, just to put in context, in the larger context, this whole question of the Iranian role in Yemen. Whatever the Iranians might have done in terms of assistance to the Houthis certainly cannot be likened to the military operations of the Saudis and the UAE and Bahrain in carrying out bombing of targets in Yemen. That Saudi bombing is a blatant violation of international law. There is no request from a legitimate government inside Yemen for outside bombing to take place, bombing to take place from a country outside Yemen. I must say that it's quite astonishing that the international community has not made a peep about this blatant violation of international law, as well as an aggression that, you know, is very serious in its consequences within Yemen. So I just want to put that question that you've posed to me in that larger context. With regard to what we do know about Iran's role in Yemen, you know, there may well be some kind of Iranian presence, relatively small presence, in the Houthi zone of Yemen, involved in training, giving some military training to the Houthis. What does appear to be not factual is the idea that Iran has poured arms into the Houthis in recent years, and particularly since last fall. And this is part of the propaganda campaign that's been waged, the suggestion that Iran has continued to arm the Houthis. That, I must say, is a bizarre idea because, as I point out in the article that I published yesterday, the Houthis, on their way into taking control of Sana'a, the capital of Yemen, last September, were absolutely able to acquire a huge bonanza of arms thanks to the political support from the former president, our former ally, who still controls the Yemeni military and who ordered essentially the entire Yemeni military to stand down and let the Houthis take over, to take these bases, which were full of American arms worth hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, they've been getting arms all right, but the arms have come from the United States through the largesse of former President Saleh.
Well, and we will, of course, continue to follow this closely, the situation in Yemen. Again, I'm speaking with Gareth Porter. He is the author of a new article, Houthi Arms Bonanza Came from Saleh, Not Iran, on the website antiwar.com. Gareth Porter is an investigative journalist. He's also the author of Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare. This is Jenka Soderberg with KBOO News.
Let's get technical with the Fukushima update. Extremely high radiation levels were found in a Tokyo playground last week, prompting authorities to evacuate the park. A local resident armed with a dosimeter designed to measure radiation discovered the radioactive hotspot and notified it authorities. The Japanese Nuclear Regulation Authority tested the playground and measured the hotspot at 480 microsieverts an hour. The maximum allowable rate of exposure is 1,000 microsieverts per year. This means that a person will receive the yearly maximum allowable dose in less than 3 hours on playing in the park. In other Fukushima news, a second robot was dispatched into the reactor number 1 building in an attempt to look into the room housing the reactor and determine where the fuel core is located. The robot died after entering the building less than 40 feet. Shortly before the robot died, it measured a radiation reading of 5,000 microsieverts an hour. Exposure to even one-tenth of that amount for 10 minutes would cause immediate radiation sickness and death within weeks. Earlier this month, just north of Fukushima, over 150 dolphins beached themselves en masse before dying. Autopsies of the dolphins showed that the cause of death was an ischemic lung disease resulting in impaired lung function. A medical study on Chernobyl emergency workers showed a statistically significant rate of ischemia from exposure to even low doses of ionizing radiation. The dolphins join numerous other species of animals and birds near the Fukushima power plant that have shown a dramatic decline in population numbers since the nuclear accident occurred in 2011.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories here at 503-231-8032. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Don Zer and Eric Takeoff. The producer is Eric Takeoff. Special thanks to Joe Meyer. Our engineer is Mike Fotoklis. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Yanka Soderberg. A podcast of local stories from this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews, or you can look for us on Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath, 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River, 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncourt.
Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, on the Abe and Joe Talk radio show, Joe Uris hosts a discussion of the loss of national sovereignty and the creation of international capitalism. At 9, on alternative radio community rights movement leader Paul Cienfuegos talks about the community rights movement. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radios with host Dennis Bernstein. And at 11, on stage and studio, host DeMay Roberts talks about age and gender equity in Portland theater with guest Jane Vogel, the founder and board president of AGE, Age and Gender Equality in the Arts. Thanks, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you are not a current member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And stay tuned for Joe Meyer's interview with the two candidates running in the special election May 19th in Portland School Board's Zone 1.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Portland Public School Board elections are May 19th. KBOO reporters Joe Meyer and Dan Merrill have interviewed all 11 candidates using questions from you, the community. These will be aired on KBOO at 5:45 for the next 4 days, Monday through Thursday. Here are Portland Public School Board Zone 1 candidates, Julia Sparza Brown and Andrew Davidson.
Portland School Board elections are May 19th. What's your question?
This is Hyung Nam. I'm a Portland Public Schools teacher. I think one of the most important questions to answer, misleadingly simple, but very important, is what do you think is the purpose of education?
Hi, I'm Julie Esparza Brown, and I am running for Portland School Board in Zone 1. I think the purpose of education is really to instill a sense of civic engagement, as well as the skills to be a productive citizen. And I think that education is a civil right that all children have. So we owe it to all children to provide the best educational opportunities for each of their own experiences possible.
My name is Andrew Davidson. I'm running for school board in Zone 1. The purpose of public education, at least, is to prepare students essentially to take them from toddlers into fully functioning citizens in their community, to make sure they're prepared for whatever the next steps in their life may be after we've, you know, graduated them. Part of, you know, having a well-functioning society is making sure that people are able to get the jobs they want, not necessarily that they're in jobs that are